This past year has seen a crisis of confidence in the future of the book. Retailers struggling, e-books and e-tailers beginning to take off. I spoke to two of the bookiest people around about the state of the industry and about what they've been reading. Kate DeGoldi, regular children's book reviewer on this programme and prize-winning author herself. And Laura Croach, formerly of these shores, now head of Adelaide Writers Week, part of the Adelaide Festival. I asked Laura how she felt about the winds of change riffling the pages of the publishing story.
I feel really optimistic about the whole thing. I think we're in great nick. I'm not entirely convinced why we're having the conniptions that we are. What I think is writers are writing and readers are reading. We're just having delivery mechanism problems. And that we'll work it out. I think ebooks are a fantastic thing because it means that the long tail really can exist now. Everything can stay in print. It's really easy to get books. And here in Adelaide, it's been interesting for me because this is a slightly older audience than I'm used to dealing with. And for old people in particular, ebooks are just absolutely revolutionary, not only because they have adjustable font, so when it's hard to see, you can read them, but also it means that as you sort of downsize in your life, your library can come with you.
Mm. I know that Kate DeGoldi here has been exploring the wonderful world of ebooks in her journeys around the globe this year. And you're a fan, aren't you, Kate?
I am, but I'm probably slightly less of a hysterical convert than I was, say, 3 months ago. I did note that, I mean, I think everything Laura's saying is exactly right, and I love the accessibility of stuff and the long tail, and I look forward to children's backlists being really available on my Kindle, which they aren't really
just
yet.
Just point of clarification, when you and Laura talk about the long tail, you mean everything being available in small parts forever, in other words.
Yeah, and backlists.
Yes.
You know, instead, I mean, I won't stop going to, say, secondhand bookshops or sourcing things from books and things like that, but the thing about the Kindle is the instant gratification wherever you are, which is what I liked a lot. And I mean,
what do you mean?
Well, you can go into an internet cafe and wherever you're travelling and get the password and download whatever book you happen to need at that moment. And for someone like me, say, who likes to travel with a variety of books so that I can have whatever suits my mood, the Kindle turned out to be fantastic. What I did notice was as soon as I got home from away, it stayed on the desk. I still want, you know, tactility and all the I still want to browse in a bookshop because things happen differently there and you see things differently.
Although, interestingly enough, and I don't know whether this is happening in Australia, Laura, or here in New Zealand, booksellers have spoken in America anyway of people showrooming, people wandering into the shop, typing into their smartphones in order to go away and buy the book more cheaply online later, which, if you were a book retailer, would be really, really irritating. Have you seen that happening?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely think it happens. But, you know, I would counter that by saying when paperbacks in New Zealand are almost $40 and here paperbacks are about $30, do you blame them?
No.
I mean, we still have to work out how we're going to price books in this market. I mean, if I wanted to buy everything that I need to read, well, one, I would have to wait for a very, very long time for it to get here still. And two, I'd have to pay a fortune.
Mm. You were talking about the downside of the ebook, though, Katie, and you didn't get to it. What was it?
Oh, well, what Laura says about price is absolutely correct. So, for instance, I will probably never buy another crime book. I read a lot of crime, but I will probably always download it now.
Oddly enough, because that's what I regard as the most disposable of all books.
I don't tend to keep them. But here's the downside.
Apart from, you know, James Lee Burke.
Yeah, yeah. Or maybe even Tom Franklin, who I might regard as a sort of superior literary crime writer, who I will keep and reread. But one thing I did realise after I started downloading the crime is one doesn't lend the Kindle. You don't pass on. And I had this really quite nice community of passing on. I used to pass on crime books all the time
to my
mother and my aunts and my sisters. Now, that doesn't happen anymore, and I may slightly regret that. But there you are. That's one of the aspects of it. I mean, there's great stuff.
It will come.
You mean you can pass on to the ebook?
Yeah, I mean, Amazon has started its lending library, and already in the States, libraries are allowed to lend ebooks. We're just sort of working out the money behind it, but I would say in another year or two, we will be able to be sharing our books off our Kindles.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, that would be nice. That would call for a critical mass of Kindles out there, presumably.
I think the critical mass is there. I mean, Kindles are selling the most, but I'd be pretty hard-pressed. Like in our office, our festival office, pretty much every person in it is reading off a device. Many people are reading off smartphones. But I think it's happened, and especially in Australasia, because we are so addicted to smartphones. Pretty much everyone's got one. And worldwide, insanely, 80% of people now have cell phones. Mm. So the moment when smartphones take over isn't that far away. And you can download a book to your smartphone in a second. In fact, you don't even need to go, Katie, we've got to get you 3G. You can do it anywhere. You don't even need to go to an internet cafe.
I know, but you know what I'm like about the wireless. I think it only happens in certain spots.
I know.
But one thing I noticed when I was in the UK was all the publishers there talked about their e-book becoming a work foundation, you know, so that it's where the manuscripts are. So then, interestingly, they have come to see the actual book as their pleasure site. So, I mean, it's going to be interesting how it
I'm not sure I understand what you just said.
Well, so all the editors and publishers that I met are using their e-books as the place where their manuscripts that they have not yet read are.
I see.
So they take it home and it's for them, their workplace.
Yes.
So suddenly the actual book becomes a site of pleasure because it's not to do with work.
I see.
And so it'll be really interesting to see how it devolves over time, you know, why and when the book then becomes a thing of beauty for other reasons and, you know, where it takes its place.
Well, I think we're already seeing that, you know, the book as an artifact rather than something more utilitarian. The other issue is whether the e-book will change the content. I mean, e-books, as I understand it, allow stories to be as long as we want them to be.
It may not be a good thing.
Well, somebody described the paper book as a kind of Procrustean bed where books really have to be this length or that length. But e-books have allowed a new genre of short books to come about. Have you noticed that, Laura?
Yeah, I mean, they definitely have they do those little kind of teasers. And one of the things that Amazon, I think, has done very cleverly is in between books, they publish short stories by writers. Mm. I guess the thing I think is interesting about that is that what the iPad and the ebook have brought back has been long journalism. Long form journalism has come back because all of a sudden, you know, with longform.org and those places. And that, I think, has been the most extraordinarily wonderful boom to come out of this, is that long form journalism is sort of recapturing some of the space we lost when all the newspapers started to disappear.
Pamphlets, people are calling it. The return of the pamphlet era.
The monograph.
And it's fantastic. Mm. It means people can have some space to think.
Hey, Laura, you've got a really interesting sort of take on the business of bookshops disappearing, which everyone gets very anxious about. And I really noticed this when I was in Australia. They seem deeply depressed, even the independent bookshops, which I thought were flourishing. But you say it's like a return to what we once had, where there was, you know, maybe one bookshop in a city.
Yeah, I mean, here it's really bad. I think what's happening in Australia is what happened in New Zealand a few years ago. There's a huge retraction going on. We've lost enormous numbers of shops. And last year at Christmas here, basically that snowstorm on the East Coast saved book selling because the book depository orders couldn't get through, which is pretty sobering. Mm. But I would argue that I think the little bookshop where your bookseller is hand selling to you will be fine. And I think we'll accommodate those businesses in a much better way.
Well, you have a personal relationship with the bookseller.
Yeah, and they support you and they get your stuff. And I mean, here you can get books from the US in about less than a week, and they will offer that personalized service. Mm. But I'm not convinced that we will need all those airport bookshops. Mm. I just think that eventually we will migrate over. I mean, I increasingly see them all as just so incredibly cumbersome to be toting all that paper about.
I know. I'm currently compiling my books to take on holiday. And honestly, I'm going to have to drive really carefully is what I'm going to have to do, because the car's going to be so loaded down.
And also, Laura, you experienced exactly that problem shifting from one country to another with your astonishingly large number of books.
Yes.
4,000 books that I decided had to come with me.
Oh, my Lord.
I know. I do.
And do you think about that now and think, well, that was silly? Or do you love the fact that you've got them all?
No, I love them. And my books are sort of, they're a multi-generation, you know, they're my parents' books and they're my books and they're books from when I was a kid. And there will always be some books that I will always want as objects because they're sort of they're memory devices. Yeah. You know, they remind me of these moments. And when I love something, I still buy the book. But I buy far fewer books. I download much more now. And also, for me, I'm really happy with the service Amazon delivers. And I'm not trying to tout it, but I do want to be able to go somewhere where the entire backlist is available, where obscure things are available, You know, for me, it's so hard to buy Canadian literature anywhere in the world. So I'm really grateful that there is a way to buy it.
Then I'm not sure why you see a future at all for the bookshop.
Because I do think that the book is an object, is an enduring object. And I think that they will always be beautiful and we will always love them. And also, it's really...
But that's such a niche market.
Yeah, it is. So are record stores.
Yeah, well, that's true.
And they're still there and people are returning to vinyl and it's becoming cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I am my own filter mechanism in that I spend a lot of time sifting through. And I think at the end of the day, there are too many books. And the thing booksellers do is say, get this one, not that one. Mm. And we'll always need that, you know, someone to be the infomediary.
And the thing is, it was always, long ago, it was a niche market. There's just been this weird blip of oversupply, really, in the last, what would you say, Laura, 30 years?
Yeah, I mean, definitely. We went... I mean, there's a fantastic book called Merchants of Culture, which is about what happened to the book industry. And we went demented in the 1980s. And we began to treat literature as a speculative market. And like most speculative markets that were born in the 80s, it was a disaster. And so now I think we're having a readjustment. We publish too many books. I mean, anything. I look at the publishing in Australia and... I mean, there are only 24 million people here. It's insane how much is being published.
Interestingly enough, I was talking to Harry Christophers last week, who is the director of this kind of legendary period choir, the 16. And he was saying that in the 80s, late 80s, 90s, people went crazy on CD production. It was CD mania. And I'm wondering if the same kind of thing was in that market as well. Huge kind of, I don't know, consumer market for the object of CD or book.
And we thought there would be these massive sales. And you saw, I mean, I can remember when Tom Wolfe, you know, would bring out a novel and his initial print run in the United States would be 1 million copies. Mm. I mean, it's bananas. Mm. And, you know, it turned out that it didn't work. Mm. And the other thing I think is, I mean, one of the things that ebooks I think will do, just what Kate was saying about crime is, for all the disposable literatures, which are the genre literatures, romance is going like gangbusters on ebooks because, of course, no one can see the jacket, so you can read them on the bus now.
Well, that would go for an awful lot of things, wouldn't it?
And well, yeah. So all of a sudden, you know, you have this privacy. And so we're seeing this explosion of ebooks among romance readers. And I think all that, getting all that stuff off the shelves is fine. And allowing it to go directly to its market and its market to engage with it is great.
I imagine it would be good for a lot of self-help books if people are still reading self-help books. I don't know. But, you know, How to Become a Better Person and Lose a Lot of Weight Simultaneously was not a book that you would want to be seen reading unless you could hide it in an e-book. Mm.
That's right. I mean, I hate not being able to see what people are reading, but I sort of love the idea that they're probably reading, you know, semi-porn on the way to the office.
I wondered also, talking about CDs, as CD sales have dropped and downloaded music becomes the norm, live acts and live shows have increased. And I wondered, and you could perhaps talk to this, Laura, is there a similar effect with writers? Face-to-face interaction with their audiences is increasingly important to them.
Absolutely.
Or it always has been, I know.
Well, has it? That's the thing.
Well, writers' festivals have always thrived.
No, but they're actually a relatively new phenomenon as well.
Oh, relatively, okay. But not since e-books, obviously.
No,
right.
This one's been going, the one that I've got now has been going for 50 years. But the thing that's made it unique is it's free. So it's always had huge audiences. I think that as not only the downloading stuff, but also as the marketing budgets disappear, festivals are going to be where we sell writers and where we build readership. And certainly in the English speaking world, the numbers just go up and up. What's happening in the UK is insane. I mean, they're just massive. Mm. And here, certainly the numbers are going up and up.
So you think that's the same as the music phenomenon?
Yeah, I think part of it's the filtering mechanism again, that when we give you a program, we say all these books are good books, these are good writers, here's a guide.
Right.
And then you get to kind of taste them, you know, you get a taster. Mm. Taste them sounds funny. And also I think it's a place where you can listen in to an intimate conversation. I was at Brisbane Festival earlier this year, and after a writer's session, a woman got up and said, thank you for speaking to us. Mm-hmm. And it just sort of reminded me of the intimacy that the live performance gives, that somehow people are really there and sharing this experience with the writer. And this is the same thing that happens in music.
Just as a matter of interest, Laura, how do you manage to keep it free?
the government pays them. Right. We're heavily subsidised by the South Australian government, but I run the book tent, so I sell books, which will be interesting. I'm not sure what's... I mean...
So the South Australian government takes the arts very seriously.
Yeah, we're the festival state. We have millions of festivals here. Yeah. And everything has a festival here. But fantastic. But there's a real commitment to keeping... We're going annual after this year, and to keeping it free. You know, Writers Week, it's extraordinary that we do this giant event and it's not ticketed.
Mm. In line with the idea of books as a kind of solace in themselves rather than something you consume and discard, you both of you, I was thinking, have had a bad year. You've each lost a parent, your father Laura and your mother Kate. And I wondered if you sought solace in books in the wake of those events.
Well, we were so intrigued to find out from each other what we had read. I certainly did. And I sort of knew Laura would have. But what I was intrigued to find out from her was what she'd read. And what I had read was consistent with what I always used to read when I went home to stay with my parents and in the period of my mother's decline. I would nearly always read Dorothy L. Sayers when I was in her house because I really associate it with her. So I went back to the Lord Peter Wimsey books. And what you're looking for there, exactly as you say, is solace, escape and predictability, because you know exactly what's going to happen. I know what lines I want to anticipate on what side of the page, which, by the way, is not something that happens with an e-book because things are not on the right side of the page for rereading, but that's a minor thing.
Well, no, I actually find that quite disorienting because when I remember a bit of a book, I always remember which side of the book it's on.
One thing it does do, though, is it means you read it again differently because it's on a different side of the page. In the same way as if you listen to an audiobook of a book that you've already read, you hear different stuff. So I read Dorothy L. Sayers, and then I found myself sort of going to my parents' bookcase, which is pretty large, and my mother's particularly, and just looking at the books that I knew that she had liked. And one of them was the Forsyth Saga, and it coincided with me watching the production that was on a few years ago in the UK. So I started reading the Forsyth Saga again. And so somehow there was a parallel re-exploring of that story, but it somehow had my mother in it, which I think is what happens a lot with reading as solace. And I did the same with children's books because she was the person who gave me all my books every Friday night and had often read them. And so there were certain titles that were associated with her childhood.
And those books would be impregnated with her presence, as later generations will not find the e-book is.
Perhaps not. No, because there was a solid object with, and this was the important thing for me about books, with a cover and often with illustrations. So that's where I went. But Laura went somewhere slightly different.
Yeah, I always go back to Graham Greene. Graham Greene is sort of my default read. Whenever I have any sort of, you know, anxiety or horribleness in my life, I always go back to Graham Greene.
Any particular one?
I always go back to The Quiet American first, and then I tend to do all the kind of political thriller ones. I don't ever do Travels with My Aunt or anything that would make me cry more. Mm. But for some reason, I think because Greene is such a terrific storyteller that you're just in his story, you know, and then it's always all that guilt just kind of makes it work.
You know,
lots of good Catholic guilt sitting there. Mm. The other person I read, which is an American thriller writer who's disappeared a long time ago, is a guy named Ross Thomas. And my mom put me onto him. And again, I think it's because it's the story. They're thrillers. They're kind of espionage thrillers. And they're weirdly and deeply American. And I think I find that really kind of reassuring. And with my dad, I read poems because he was a poet. And it was, I think like Kay, my father had moved into a retirement home and had a very, very pared down library. And most of it was poetry. And it gave me huge solace reading the poems that I knew he'd been reading. And he read William Carlos Williams all of his life. I mean, all the time I knew him. And so I read a lot of William Carlos Williams. And Mary Oliver, who's a really terrific contemporary American, well, she's in her 80s now, but, and poetry does that too. Mm. And it's true, like, hey, I carry Graham Greene around with me a lot on the Kindle, and I like that because it's always there. But the poetry, yeah, I still read that on the page.
Mm. You know, I know a family who, when their father was very ill in hospital, they were all Georgette Heyer aficionados. And
Regency romance.
Yeah, all of them, the men and the women in the family. And,
really?
And there was this wonderful kind of image that was conjured up for me by my friend telling me about them all sitting around his bed when he was still unconscious, and they were all reading bits of, they all had Georgette Heyer books with them. I mean, I think probably we underestimate how important, how sort of totemic it is, and how context, when we first read a book, becomes so much part of the reading. So, you know, they had literally all come to that together as a collective, as a family. Mm. And similarly for Laura, the associations with her father as a writer. And her. Laura, do you think the fact that Ross Thomas is so American is important because America is on one level home?
Yeah, absolutely.
And so returning also, to a place of comfort in a way.
Yeah. Mm. And I think because it reminds me of my mother and, you know, sometimes, I mean, there's, as much as I love living in this part of the world, there is that moment when you get off the plane at JFK and all of a sudden you're just completely anonymous again and everybody has a weird accent like you do, is the most fantastic feeling in the world. Mm. And I think for me, going back into Ross Thomas is kind of, I just disappear and it's a nice feeling.
I'm talking to Laura Croach in Adelaide and Kate de Goldie here in New Zealand. And the books they are talking about, authors, details, will all be on our website. All right, the book that you would thrust upon everybody at the end of this year. I think you both agree, and somebody was talking to me about it the other day, I haven't read it, Jennifer Egan's A Visit from the Goon Squad.
Mm-hmm.
What is it, and why do you love it so? Kate?
I would describe it as either a series of interconnected stories or a discontinuous narrative, an interrupted novel. In some ways, it's kind of uncategorizable. It's about the music industry in some ways. It's about a bunch of people who are interconnected. They come in and out of each other's stories, sometimes as minor characters, sometimes as major characters. I saw it ultimately as a really redemptive series of narratives. People, you're on the brink of seeing people disappear out of their lives, destroy themselves, partly because it's set in the music industry at different times. People are living extreme, volatile, self-destructive lives. And then suddenly a character will appear again years later, redeemed in some unlikely, bonkers way. Mm-hmm. She's a terrific writer. She paints character with enormous enthusiasm and humour and pathos. She's quite, I mean, a lot of her characters aren't kind of entirely likeable, even though she's incredibly funny a lot of the time. So you're just caught up in this incredible swirl of lives. It seemed to me a deeply American narrative because it was about making oneself and unmaking oneself and then redeeming oneself.
You agree with that, Laura?
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I really loved about it is that she gives you aha moments every chapter. You know, it's just she continues to go, oh, snap, now I got it. And she kind of makes you work in a way that makes you feel incredibly happy with yourself.
And but none of it's contrived, is it? I mean, she's playing with technically with the form. I mean, there's a whole chapter. Laura described the one about the quiet moments in music.
So one of the characters comes back and she's a parent who appears at the beginning of the novel, and her daughter does a PowerPoint presentation about her brother's. Her brother counts the silence in music. And what you realize as it unfolds is this PowerPoint presentation is the most beautiful and moving description of autism I've ever read. And she just sneaks up on you and then she does these amazing reveals and you go far out. And she is, as Kate was saying, they aren't sympathetic, but she has this enormous empathy for her characters without any sentimentality attached to it.
All right, I will put that on my list. The other interesting thing,
it
seems to me, this year is a whole bunch of books from Carolina or Appalachia, that part of America, Ron Rash and Daniel Woodrell. And I know you've enjoyed these, Kate. What about you, Laura? Because, I don't know, have you been looking at those? I know Ron Rash is one of your faves.
Yeah, Ron Rash is on my list. I'm a Tom Franklin fan. The other one I would add, and he's a newfie, so completely different places. The novel I've just really loved this year is a novel by Michael Crummie, a Canadian writer, called Galore. And it is quite different to, it's like Serena on speed, I guess. It's this fantastic multi-generational story set in Newfoundland. It begins in the 19th century. And it opens with a man being cut out of the belly of a whale. And he is a mute albino. And he lives in this mad town with these mad people who have names like Divine's Widow, and that's the only name. And I think what's sort of different, the Southern stuff, I think, is so kind of grounded in the poverty and the unhappiness of the history of the American South.
It's very grim. It's always very grim. It's really grim. And these days, a lot of pee or drugs or meth involved in it.
It's massive. Whereas I think the thing I loved about Galore is that it's sort of, Newfoundland is a it's a poor place, it's an isolated place, but there's this amazing redemptive quality. And Crummy's just a fantastic writer.
And it's the same thing with Tom Franklin and Daniel Woodrell, and Ron Resch perhaps to a lesser degree. I discovered Tom Franklin quite late because he's written a number of books, but the most recent one, and I've just forgotten the name of it, Crooked Letter,
yeah.
Which is the same thing. We're dealing with sort of degraded, sad people in poor, disenfranchised parts of America. But I thought the thing with Crooked Letter was there were some of the most beautiful descriptions of manual work that I've ever read, which they were homages, really, to that kind of life and to the life of the working man. And that's a redemptive tale, Crooked Letter. And Daniel Woodrell's Winter's Bone is a fabulous character study of a girl just determined to save herself and her siblings from degradation.
Which made a very good movie, actually.
Yeah, yeah.
I read True Grit this year, actually, talking about Americana, and really loved it and realised what a great book it was in the first instance before they made it into the John Wayne movie. And now it's been kind of revisited in movie form. But go back, have either of you read it?
No, I just
saw it. Really good.
Yeah,
it's a sweet, very short, and sometimes very funny book.
Yeah, and that whole business of rediscovering classics that somehow passed you by is an important part of one's yearly reading as well.
I love that. So what would you take on holiday with you, or what will you take on holiday with you, more to the point, Laura? If you get a holiday, are you getting holidays?
I'm coming back to New Zealand.
Oh, good.
The top of my list is a book by Wade Davis called Into the Silence, and it's a nonfiction book about George Mallory's 1924 failed attempt ascent of Everest.
Oh.
And it's about the Great War and the sort of the spirit of what was lost as that generation went into the war. It's getting absolutely terrific reviews.
Interesting that he chose that title, because we've had Into the Void.
Yeah.
Similarly, sort of snowy torture movies and books, Into the Silence. About more than Mallory, obviously.
Yeah, it's about that generation. And so it begins in 24 with the failed ascent, and it ends with them dying in the trenches.
Wait, he's taking it for granted that it was, in fact, a failed ascent, is he?
I haven't read it yet.
Oh, well, okay.
Because, you know, Hillary get there?
Well, there are still some people out there who think that George Mallory may have got to the top.
I didn't know that. It's actually quite crucial that I read that.
Laura, you could read along with that, because it's the same territory. Harry Rickett's book about the war poets.
Yeah, I was thinking I will.
Where he imagines, it's called Strange Meetings, I think, which I'm looking forward to reading in the holidays. Yeah.
Is this revisiting the sort of Pat Barker territory?
No, well, yes and no, because it's that they're great war poets, but he's writing
Wilfred
about
Owen and Siegfried Sassoon.
And others, he's either imagining or describing actual meetings between them, and so out of that comes a kind of, well, it's not fiction and it's not quite biography. It's a sort of a blend, and I've heard him read from it. It's fantastic.
Good.
So I'm looking forward to reading that.
All right. What else are you taking on hold?
What else am I taking? I'm reading quite a bit of Canadian fiction right now.
Yeah.
They seem to be having a bit of a whack. So I've got The Sisters Brothers, the Patrick DeWitt, which is a sort of, I haven't read it yet, but what I understand about it, it's a mad Western set in the 1850s and a kind of rift on the genre. The other writer I'm reading is a woman named Jessica Grant, who reminds me a lot, Kate, you'll know of, who reminds me of Lisa Moore.
Mm. Say the name again.
Her name is Jessica Grant.
Yes.
And she reminds me of Alligator, the style of the book. And this one, I think it's called O Thou Tortoise. I haven't written it down properly. And it begins, it has this fantastic, I've recently started, as this beautiful beginning where it opens and a woman's on a plane and gets the call that her tortoise may be dead. It's the really weird quirkiness of those writers.
Interesting.
I think she's a newfie too.
I guess Alligator and Tortoise.
And yeah. Newfoundland. There's something wacky about Newfoundland. And the other one, which Kate and I are both looking forward to, is the new Margot Lanigan.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, Sea Hearts.
Me
wait.
Too. I just think she's extraordinary.
Again, to do with the sea. Selkies.
We were talking, Kate and I were talking about Margot Lanigan the other day in the context of Kelly Link. Because she's kind of similarly uncategorisable.
Slipstream, Kim, it's the new phrase for me.
What does that mean?
Oh, you know, I'd read the word interstitial to describe that kind of fiction.
Slipstream's easier to spell, I guess.
Yeah, and Margaret Atwood, the book I'm looking forward to reading is Margaret Atwood's book about sci-fi and the human imagination.
Mm-hmm.
And she's talking about her adventures in sci-fi, and she talks about all those sort of attempts to categorise and uses the word slipstream. And I think Kelly Link, Margot Lanigan...
I don't see how slipstream means the same as interstitial.
Well, slipstream, I suppose, is referring to the fact that somehow it's sort of moving between genres in a way. I mean, Kelly Link is kind of a fantastical writer, but she's a sort of supercharged realist writer as well. And so is Margot Lanigan. I mean, they're not quite creating whole other worlds. They're giving us our world, but bent out of shape.
Yes.
And which it was infinitely more disturbing to me.
Yes, yes. It's exactly like you have those dreams where everything is the same, except not quite.
No, that's right.
And they're the scariest dreams.
Yeah. And another book I'm looking forward to, I'm really quite enamoured of Kelly Link now, and that whole kind of slipstream genre. And she and her husband, Gavin Grant, run a press called Small Beer, and they have edited a book which is published by Walker, which I've got at home now, called Steampunk, an anthology of fantastically rich and strange stories. And Elizabeth Knox, who of course is a huge aficionado of both Kelly Link and steampunk generally, she has a story in there, and so does Dylan Horrocks.
Oh, right.
So, and that looks like a sumptuous book. I can't wait for that.
Where's she from, Kelly Link?
Massachusetts.
Is it?
Okay.
Yeah.
And Laura, what's the name of that fantastic zine that you used to subscribe to her zine?
Lady Churchill's Wristlet.
Isn't that the best name?
Yes, yeah. It is.
Which reminds me, Kim, one of the things I wanted to say was that one of the best things I've read this year is a zine essay sent to me by a friend who made it. It was a most beautiful exploration of gardening and ageing and dealing with declining parents. The zine and that kind of casual personal publishing, and she just distributed it to a few friends, is a remarkable part of our literary culture, which is, of course, sort of outside of commerce in
lots
of ways.
Did she distribute it in material form?
Yeah.
Or online?
Yeah, in material form.
Right.
And I mean, that seems to me something that, well, I'd really like to explore it as a form, and it's flourishing in an underground way hugely. I mean, there's a zine conference here every year, and it's really big in Australia. Mm. Laura, are you aware of it?
Adelaide's a big city, I think. Like all kind of sort of conservative places, it has a nice, healthy underbelly. Yeah. And zine culture is really does really well here. And there's a lot. There's a format festival. There's an alternative literary festival. The other thing I wanted to add to that is I think that zines and the weird things that people produce will always stay in paper. I am a huge fan of an American essayist named Ander Monson. And he does this mad literary journal called Diagram. And the last issue was a deck of cards, and each card had a piece of original writing on it.
Mm.
And I think that the way we play with language and the way we play with form, paper will always be a medium where we do that. You can't give someone a deck of cards virtually. That said, he has this amazing website for Diagrams that leads you through all these pages and through all these journeys. And I think he's a great example of someone who does both. His last book is terrific. It's called Neck Deep and Other Predicaments. But he's worth reading for people who are interested in that kind of wacky nonfiction.
We haven't spoken about nonfiction a great deal, apart from Wade Davis, I guess. Kate, any nonfiction picks?
Well, at the beginning of the year, I had a massive nonfiction phase along with my Southern Men phase. And the person I absolutely loved was Terry Castle's book, The Professor, which is the most wonderful book of essays. She writes often in the London Review of Books. She's a professor herself. And she ranges over the most extraordinary array of subjects. The first essay is about her love affair with the First World War and the memorabilia of it, the people who are involved with it. And I mean, she has a kind of academic take on it, but she's a very accessible writer. But she also has a fantastic essay about one Christmas when she starts listening to Art Pepper when she's staying with her mother, so she can write about jazz fabulously. And then there's an hysterical essay about her friendship with Susan Sontag, which was once in the London Review of Books, which is just brilliant because she's kind of... Susan Sontag was so mean to her, yeah, and was actually a first-class bitch, from what I can work out. But it's the funniest.
Speak ill of the dead. Yeah, she was a tricky person.
And then there's a very, very long essay in the book about her relationship, her lesbian relationship with a professor, an influential person in her life. So it's an extraordinary range of material. She's so funny, she's so deprecating, she's so smart. Mm. And I can't wait for more from her. And the other one for me was a wonderful book called Just My Type about fonts, which sort of speaks in a way to what you were saying, Laura, about the zine and things like that staying around forever on paper, because they're somewhere between art and literature, and the font as a sort of agent of literature is a really interesting history. And this book talks about the people behind the fonts, both contemporary and in the past, and it sent me off on a whole lot of explorations into people like Eric Gill, who was this rather peculiar Englishman who's behind, I've forgotten which font it is now, thanks, Mark Gill Sands. So that was a great read, and one of those reads that expands your knowledge quite kind of easily and then sends you off to a whole lot of other material, which I liked a lot.
Right. Did either of you have, as you said earlier, Laura, an aha moment in terms of reading, like something that you stumbled on that completely astonished you?
Yeah, my little jag that I'm on is a guy named John Jeremiah Sullivan, and he's written this just a fantastic book of essays called Pulphead. And he writes like a novelist in that there's this extraordinary sense of story and of narrative. But he, I guess like Kate was saying about the font guy, it's just kooky what he writes about, probably more like Terry Castle. So he writes an essay about an obscure American naturalist that no one's ever heard of, who's clearly mad. He writes about a Christian rock festival, which is howlingly funny, but he's never mean, and he's quite sympathetic to these kids in Christian rock. He writes about music a lot. He writes a terrific piece about the complete madness that is Axl Rose, which is fantastic, and he goes back to his town. He's from Tennessee. He's a Southerner, and he has also written, I've also read his memoir, which is, his father was a sports writer, and he writes this memoir about his father and his father's sort of failed career, in the sense he was never a novelist. And he puts it against a history of thoroughbred horse racing. And it's just, yeah, he's definitely my surprise of the year. I was just, Pulphead is getting a lot of attention, and it was one of those things.
He sounds like he's got a New Yorker sensibility in terms of the magazine, yeah, you know, that they can write about things that you never thought you'd be interested in, and then they become
interesting. Yeah, like, Laura, you would be so interested in thoroughbred horse racing.
I know. Yeah. Well, I loved it. It was absolutely fantastic. It was, yeah, he is. He's a GQ writer. He's a magazine writer. Mm. And he's a long format guy. And, he's my latest, my pick. I thought he was just fantastic.
And what those people are always doing is excavating with curiosity, aren't they? They just delve. The work is so interesting because you're following their journey of finding out.
Yes, exactly.
Which is just, and actually, I suppose,
because they usually start off from a position of ignorance.
Yeah.
And they take you with them.
My equivalent of that would be someone less sort of edgy, I guess, but and he's writing often about classical music, but also about contemporary music, is Alex Ross.
He's just such a good writer, isn't he?
Oh, and I read his... I know a reasonable amount about classical music, but he explains what I'm hearing, rather like a very good wine writer can tell you what you're tasting. And so describing Brahms's last works or the way a Schubert sonata works is... I mean, but you could still read it without knowing a lot about that because he broadens it at the same time as he's specialising. It's quite a fantastic art, really.
He wrote that big fat book about
20th century music. I don't know much about, I don't know a lot about contemporary rock music. So his essay about Radiohead and his essay about Bjork are just as enthralling to me as the ones about, say, Schubert and Brahms or, you know, the conductor from Norway or whatever.
All right. And next year, any highlights from either of you? Kate? You've had such a highlight year.
Well,
you've been hither and thither and collecting prizes.
I'm going to be going to Laura's festival in Adelaide, which is incredibly exciting.
And that's in March.
Right. Yeah, and then, yes, of course, we've got our Wellington Writers Festival here, where we'll be sharing some of the same writers.
That's right.
But also with a different bunch. And I guess I'm particularly looking forward to Kelly Link. Now that she's my new best literary friend. On the page, as we say.
Yeah, yeah. And Laura, obviously your March Festival is a highlight.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to it. We've traditionally not done a lot of nonfiction at this festival, and we have some incredible people coming. One I'm really looking forward to is a woman named Eliza Griswold, who wrote a book called The Tenth Parallel. And she's an American journalist who
traveled. Such a good name, isn't it?
It's fantastic. She traveled for 7 years along the 10th parallel, which is the line of latitude, 100 miles, I think, from the equator. And it's where Muslims and Christians collide. And it's the place in the world where climate change is exacerbating the conflict. And she makes this quite moving argument for us in the West who simply don't understand this, that the question is, who will speak for God? And that we aren't looking at these conflicts in a way that is intelligible. I found it an incredibly moving book. And the other one, because I am quite fascinated with the Middle East, like we all are right now, is a man named MJ Akbar, who wrote a really terrific book. It's coming out in Australasia this month, I think. It's called Tinderbox. And it's a history. He's an Indian Muslim. And it's a history of Pakistan that begins in the 12th century and chronicles all the Muslim dynasties that ran India. And so he begins Pakistan in the 12th century.
But Pakistan didn't exist in the 12th century.
That's correct. And he says, well, this is Pakistan is the end result of this relationship between the Muslims and the Hindus that goes back to the 12th
century.
I see. And so he sort of completely makes us look at it in a different way. It's incredibly readable. So those are my two. And then my weird jag that I'm on is I'm really become really fascinated with African crime writing. And there's all this stuff beginning to come out, which is not by Alexander McCall Smith.
Yes, thank God.
Hooray. Huh. And it's quite, there's a
nice
lot
Nice as he is. He's a lovely chap, but he has dominated a certain genre, yes.
And what is getting produced is two things. One is this quite hard-boiled noir stuff, and most of these writers are writing out of Africa. They still live there. And the thing that I'm finding
Can we call it noir if it comes out of Africa?
Yeah, I think it's
okay. It's the style. It's the hard-boiled style.
It's not referring to colour or face.
Just checking.
We'll be okay. And what is so confronting about it is it makes you realise how stylized, you know, LA crime is and Chicago crime, because the violence, one of the recurring themes that's so hard is these street children getting killed, and they're just killed. Oh. And there's something really confrontational about the violence, because you realize it is directly coming out of the culture. Mm. And the other thing that's really interesting are African writers who are also writing in English and are sort of clawing back the territory from Alexander McCall Smith, who are writing these sort of sympathetic detective characters.
Well, they're quaint, aren't they? I mean, it's got nothing to do with the culture.
No.
What Alexander McCall Smith is writing, it seems to me. It's confection.
No, and so it's nice that, and there seems to be a lot coming, and it's really interesting. So that's my little thing that I'm on this year. And I think it'll be the next thing that pops through in crime, will be African crime.
And Laura, your festivals are, who's the author of Celebration, or whatever it's called at the festival?
Margot Lanigan.
Which is a first, a children's or young adult writer being the major writer at the festival.
Well, she deserves it. She's the genius, actually. It's a big year next year, of course, in Europe, we should say, for New Zealand, guest of honour at the 2012 Frankfurt Book Fair, and we'll see more translations and more New Zealand writers and publishers going over to literary events, and Kate's just back from winning the German Literary Prize that we talked about the other week for the 10 p.m. question now in translation, and Kate camps there in Berlin on a fellowship, and the Leipzig Book Fair is in March, also 2012. Do you think, either Kate or Laura, that this is going to be a kind of, in any way, a breakthrough event for New Zealand in terms of literary comprehension? You know, everybody knows about Catherine Mansfield and maybe Janet Frame. That's about it for New Zealand writing overseas. Laura?
I hope so. You know,
she said weekly. Well, you can do better than that.
I think it's going to be how much and how quickly they get stuff into translation. You know, I think that having the splash is fantastic, but they're going to have to back it up really quickly with getting those books into other languages. I do think that, I mean, in Germany and like Canada, there are these little pockets of communities that are really fascinated with New Zealand literature Italy does a bit of that. And I just think it's about getting stuff into translation quickly, which hopefully they will. Mm. Katie?
Oh, I agree. I mean, quality is always going to speak in the end. So, and I know there has to be delivery mechanisms.
Quality has always found it very difficult to holler across the distances involved. Yeah.
But the thing I think is fantastic about the Germans, as you know, I noticed in my whole 5 days there, that they have a very high literary sensibility. So this will be about getting the best of our literature, which is a great thing for us, because often that's been the stuff that hasn't travelled as well. So I'm hopeful.
Laura Croach and Kate de Goldie. And if you want all the details of the books that they mentioned and more, go to our website page, radionz.co.nz/Saturday.